not on the top of phase because phase doesn't go the same way, but is just a little lower. Back to you.
As you go through a resonator peak, the phase does change most rapidly right at the center frequency where the resonator is tuned. You go through an S-curve of phase shift. That's sort of typical. By the way, earlier you mentioned that on one of your analyzers, the reference channel can be switched to either 1 megohm or 50 ohms. In the 1 megohm position, I am guessing, but I'm not sure, that reference channel is intended to be connected to a crystal detector. You can buy a kind of directional coupler, which on the directional sensing port, it is intended to be connected to a crystal detector, and then the amplitude that's on that port of the directional coupler is being read by way of the crystal detector during rectification. And in many cases, you terminate the crystal detector with 1 megohm in order to take that reading. That's one possible explanation. That's a guess on my part. Also, there are kinds of directional couplers where the directional port is intended to come out with a sine wave of 50 ohms impedance, and therefore you would be adjusting your analyzer for a 50 ohm termination in order to properly read that signal on that reference port. That's what I think is taking place. Some analyzers have the switch for that reason. Is that possible from any of the owner's manual you've read so far on the use of that analyzer, Wesley? N2XJN, K2RIW?
Yes, it is possible. As a matter of fact, as far as the manuals, I have so many manuals for so many devices that I acquired recently, I didn't read them carefully. I'm going to be honest. But I have somebody who is absolutely amazing in it, and that's Eric. And he was at my house, and he was actually, we disassembled one of the crystal resonators from old Motorola board, and we have the directional coupler. I have, after Eric told me to buy them, I bought three of them. So I have them. And he was able actually to check accuracy of my network analyzer, and he was standard with the accuracy about it, on it. That was the expression that I've got. Back to you.
Eric? Yeah, Wesley? I mean, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, you've got to understand that the way Wesley is operating, he's really not operating as a vector network analyzer. He's really operating as a tracking generator and a sweep generator. And he's looking at the bandpass of the device he's looking at. And essentially what he's reading is the phase angle at which the sweep is occurring at any particular point in the bandpass. So in essence, what he's really looking at is the various different angles of group delay.
Okay, it sounds like it's a vector measurement, which requires some interesting interpretations. By the way, if you're going to be around a little while after we answer Tony's question, I've got a couple of questions for you for home use of three-dimensional television and three-dimensional Blu-ray observation. You're going to be around for a little while, Eric, go ahead.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, that's, as I said, the August issue of IEEE Spectrum Magazine, Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, Spectrum Magazine, August issue, has a whole series of articles on three-dimensional television, starting on page 18, I guess it is. Yes. And it's got two or three articles on the subject, so I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. It's going to take... I did mail you, Wesley, an email that'll give you a little bit of hints about the use of directional couplers. When you get a chance to study that, it's kind of a long article. I gave you a website, and that may help a little bit as to what a directional coupler does, how you can use them. And the good news is that in many cases, a directional coupler can be used far below frequency it was designed for. In other words, if you're making measurements at 0 to 100 megacycles, in theory you could buy a 200 megacycle directional coupler and with proper calibration use it across that whole frequency region. Not many people know that. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Ski Golf Bravo, additional question.
Okay, N2XJN. Yeah, I saw the article, and thank you very much. And it was written by the guy who is actually the guru in the TechNet, and he's for 27 and a half years helping others to understand more. Thank you very much, and I do appreciate your help. N2XJN.
Okay, the person who ended in Bravo with an additional question on this subject, what was that?
KC2WGV. No, it's a different question altogether, Dick. Take care of Tony.
Okay. Tony, one of the things that Mel and I are not very good at is telling you to buy brand A antenna and don't buy brand B. We're not really good at that. If it's a popular antenna and a whole lot of people have signed in and they've used it and they love it, or a whole lot of people signed in and they hate it because it falls apart, yeah, we'll give you that information. But when it comes to comparison, in other words, if I'm trying to buy a 2 meter at 440 dual band antenna, and I got brand A, B, and C at price A, B, and C, we're not very good at that, so I'll give you some warning on that one. KC2, UJL, K2RIW. Go ahead, Tony.
Okay. Well, I've been very patiently sitting here waiting for you to speak with you on this. It's the ultimate compact 8-band antenna, HVU-8 antenna, both vertical and horizontal. It looks like two ground plane antennas, one on top of each other. It operates 80 meters, 40 meters, 20 meters, 15 meters, and 10 meters. And I'm looking at it in the magazine here. ESASE. Okay. And I just want to know if you know about this antenna.
I don't know about that antenna, but maybe Mel does. K2KEY, have you ever heard of that HVU-8 band antenna? Over to you, Mel.
Well, you know, we reviewed this, Dick, a number of weeks ago. If you remember, we did go extensively into a number of these antennas. This just happens to be one of them. And I guess you're better than go through the whole thing again, because we did spend, if you remember, a couple of weeks on it. The experiments that were done on similar antennas by Jerry Civic and all, it's easier for someone to actually go back and listen to the amateur radio TV and hear our dissertation on it, Dick, than try to tackle it again. Over.
As you can tell, I'm not much of an HF operator. I'm a VHF, UHF, SHF operator. So when it comes to HF antennas, my memory is pretty poor. Tony, when you go to that website that Mel just talked about, www.amateurradio.tangovictor. That's the beautiful website run by Mike Perry. And after a couple of weeks, he not only records all of our past TechNets, but he eventually writes down documentation every 10 minutes what subject was being discussed. So in theory, you can go back a couple of weeks, go to that website, play back that particular tape, and as I remember, I think we spent a total of about 2 hours on that subject. Does that seem approximately right, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
We spent a number of weeks, you remember. It was broken up into a number of sections because you remember that somebody was asking us how to go about experimenting with similar antennas before they lay down that kind of money. If you remember, we looked in the magazines, we discussed ones that were in the magazines and reviewed them fairly closely, Dick, over.
Okay, looks like that is a subject that we've spent weeks and therefore hours of TechNet time on that subject already, Tony. About the best I can promise, because it's not documented yet. In other words, Mike Perry is a couple of weeks behind on, in other words, the actual recordings are there, and they're available to you. But what's on each one of those recordings, it takes him another couple of weeks to write down the documentation. In other words, every 10 minutes or so, he tells you what subject was being discussed. Eventually, that documentation is there. You'll be able to go directly to it. If I get a chance, no promise, but if I get a chance in the next week, I'll try to find the week and the hour in which we discuss that subject, and next week I'll tell it to you if you haven't already found it yourself. That's probably about the best we can do right now, Tony. KC2UJL, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay. I'll check that.com then. And I appreciate your patience, Dick. What can I say? Anyway, you don't want to disrupt the whatever's going on. Whatever's going on, looking at the stats on this antenna. So, okay, no problem. KC2UJL on site.
Studio with a question, Dick.
Very fine, Rich. Tony, it is not .com. You said you're going to go to that .com. The website is www.amateurradio.tangovictor. It's not .com. It's .tangovictor. It's an unusual one. You go there, you'll find all of the past recordings for 4 solid years of TechNet. Every one of the, and they're in 1 hour reels. John's got a question, and maybe you've got a quick one on this particular subject, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick. I think you know I'm putting up a Glenn Martin tower. It's a roof-mounted tower. It should be here in about a week. And I'm not going to ask you for a comparison on brands. I know you don't do that. But I'm considering a 7-element, 6-meter beam by M-squared, and I know there were some issues with some of the M-squared, like the HL loop, where the SW wall would rise when it got wet. They use a hairpin match. Do you know if there are any issues with that 7-element beam or any of their other antennas, Dick? 6-meter 7-element beam by M-squared.
There, I'm not sure. But we're going to go to that. There's one guy ahead of you, as I told you. I thought you were asking a question on the subject that was on the table at the time. Let me go to John first, and then we'll come right back to you. KC2WGB, you're the next person on the list. Go right ahead, John.
I'm sorry, Dick. I misunderstood. John, pick it up.
That's all right, Rich. Dick, thank you for taking my second question. I experienced something maybe you could help me with. Let me let it drop. Or rather, help me understand. One of my spectrum analyzers, when I put my pulse generator into the 50-ohm port with 50-ohm cable, everything's terminated at 50 ohms, with a T-connector bridging off to my oscilloscope, I set the generator for 2 volts peak-to-peak, and when I turn the analyzer on, it drops 60%, and it only does it on this one analyzer. Is that a different type of attenuator, an active attenuator that's causing that problem? Maybe you could explain that to me.
Yeah, when you're on the lowest range of a spectrum analyzer, which in many brands, the very first range goes from 0 to 2 gigs approximately, and then the second range goes from 2 to 4 gigs and so on. On the very first range, on many spectrum analyzers, the very first thing you see is an up-converting mixer. And many of these well-designed spectrum analyzers, the first IF is something like 2.1 gigahertz. So everything from 0 to 2 gigs is up-converted to something like 2.1 gigs, the first IF. There's a bunch of reasons why they do it that way. The bottom line, though, is that the very first thing you're looking into is the RF port of a mixer. you're never, never supposed to exceed 1 volt of input to that connector on the front panel. And in many cases, if you go to the owner's manual, it'll tell you don't go above 0 dBm or plus 30 dBm or plus 20 dBm. They'll give it to you in RF power. They also give it to you as a DC voltage. Well, when it comes to a square wave generator, which usually is operating at very low frequencies as far as RF circuits are concerned, in other words, you might be running at a 10 kc rate of square wave, which means you're 100 microseconds, 50 microseconds positive and 50 microseconds negative. Well, to an RF spectrum analyzer, that 50 microseconds of positive 2 volts looks to it like DC. And if you exceed 1 volt, you might be damaging that mixer. So some of the better spectrum analyzers, let me drop, have got a protection circuit in the front end that when it sees more than, say, 1 volt, it throws in a 10 or a 20 decibel RF attenuator in order to self-protect the front end. Many of these analyzers, when you first turn it on, it wakes up with 10 or 20 decibels of attenuation in the front end internally in order to protect it from this situation. And only when you specifically dial in 0 dB of RF attenuation, it'll give you a bunch of warnings on the screen saying the signal better not be better than 1 volt and it better not be better than plus 20 dBm or so on, otherwise you might damage the mixer. So the effect that you're describing could be the protection circuit of that particular analyzer. What brand and model number was that, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
It's an HP 85A. Nice little machine. What I'm going to do, 3585A. So then if I drop it down to a half a volt, it should not do that. That's what I'm getting from what you're saying.
If my speculation is correct, then yes, that's true. Many of the better spectrum analyzers, you're never supposed to exceed 1 volt into the front end if you're in the 0 dB RF attenuation mode. When you are in the higher attenuations, like 20 or 30 decibels of RF attenuation, then some of them can tolerate as much as 1 watt, which is around 7 volts RMS, 10 volts peak, I think it is the absolute maximum you're allowed to do. So it might be the protection mechanism that's making it drop down. And so with a lower signal level, it would be an interesting experiment. You should also check on that particular section of the owner's manual. John, go ahead.
Okay, why would I comment on it?
Go ahead, Bill.
We'll recognize. Yes, okay, Dick. I'll put that experiment on my list. That's what I'm going to do, but I think you're probably more than right. That sounds correct. Go ahead, Bill.
Thanks. No, I was just going to say, I've used extensively the 85 series newer packet spectrum analyzed 8566 and 62s, the 92 series, in the past. And as I remember, the input amplitude range was from 109 dBm to plus 30 dBm. That's the range that you stay in with the input range of amplitude range of those spectrum analyzers. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, you're absolutely right, Mel, but there's even one further caveat. Minus anything you like up to plus 30. Be careful with the plus 30. Plus 30 is 1 watt. And if you've got the RF attenuator commanded to 0 decibels, you cannot go to plus 30 dBm, 1 watt. The plus 30 dBm is only true if at least 20 dB of RF attenuation is dialed in. And many of them wake up that way in order to self-protect. So even with that range you gave it, be careful at the plus 30. You could do damage at plus 30 if you've got 0 dB of RF attenuation. I wonder if you've run into anything like that, Mel. Go ahead.
Hey, that's why they got built into it. They got the, what they call the 1-3 sequencer that protects you. Exactly. That's exactly how it works. They call the 1, three sequences, Dick. Over.
Yeah, the 1, 3, 5, 10 sequencer is for adjusting the sweep speed and sweep width. But the RF attenuation is 10 dB, 20 dB, 30 dB. RF attenuation. IF attenuation, I think it can be dialed in 1 dB steps. But the RF attenuation on most of the analyzers happens in 10 decibel steps. And there's a bunch of reasons why they did it that way. Okay, Rich, when it comes to a 7-element, 6-meter, M-squared beam, M-squared, each of the guys I know who have put up an M-squared antenna have said, hey, that's nice and rugged. They're very happy with that brand name as far as mechanical engineering is concerned. And when it comes to electrical performance, a 7-element, I'm guessing it's around 22 foot of boom length on 6 meters. Is that approximately true, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW?
Oh, you're close, Dick. Kind of look at the specs again. It just makes it in on my property. It's about 26 feet. They rated it 10.1 dBd.
And I think that that is possible, if that's what you're asking. What you're asking is, can 7 elements equal that amount of gain? Now, it turns out that the best guy I know of that can predict the maximum gain you can get out of a Yagi is Dr. Gunter Hock, DL6WU, Delta Lima 6 Whiskey Uniform. He's published a formula in the German magazine that once you dial in the exact number of feet of boom length and the frequency, assuming you have the proper distribution of directors, he tells you exactly what gain is achievable. I'm going to see if I've got that on this particular calculator I'm looking at right now. Okay, it's not in that particular file. Yes, I found it. Okay, I found the formula, and with a little bit of difficulty, you'd like to know at 50.15 megacycles, can 26 feet of boom on that frequency give you 10 and a fraction decibels of gain? I think that's part of your question. Is that true? Go ahead.
Yes, Dick, but also what I'm very concerned about, I know that on some of the M squared I've heard on this net you've mentioned, I think the HO loop that they make, it uses a hairpin match, and when it gets wet, the SWR goes up. That was one of my concerns, Dick.
I'm doubtful. So in other words, you're worried about on a wet day, is the antenna going to lose gain? Let me find the evaluation. Okay, there it is. According to the Gunter Hock formula, 26 feet of boom on 50.15 megacycles is capable of 12.37 dB over isotropic, which if I subtract 2.14, that's the gain of a dipole, it means it's capable of 10.23 dB of gain over dipole. And that's about the maximum you're going to get. Sounds very close to what the M square is claiming. I wonder if Mel knows whether or not water on that loop can make the gain go away. I wonder if any of the guys in the Kings County Radio Club have run into that. K2KEY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mel.
Oh, I heard mention of this, Dick, and there was a discussion on that with the hairpin match. And from what I recall, it was determined that the neutral point on the hairpin match was the fault. If you realize that the neutral point actually grounds to the boom, I think that's what they were discussing, that there was some kind of question as to the mechanic there, if something with corrosion was setting in, because they clamped it to the neutral point on the hairpin to the boom, Dick. Over.
When you say hairpin, okay, that means there's a center-fed driven element, a dipole. That hairpin is a sort of a distributed twin lead, inductor-like thing. And at the right tap point is where the coaxial cable is fed. So I think you're saying the corrosion there can change the characteristic in some way. Is that what you guys have encountered there, Mel? Go ahead.
Wait a minute. No, it's not set up like that, Dick. You got a hunk of coax cable. I'm trying to picture what it was exactly, you know. Not reasonably. You got a piece of coax cable that acts as the vellum. And then you have this pin. It's a stiff piece of wire, if I'm not mistaken, that sort of loops around and goes through, they call it the neutral point, on the hairpin and grounds to the boom, Dick. If I'm not mistaken, that's the way it's laid out on it. I mean, I'm just doing this off the top of my head from what I heard the description over.
Okay. Do you believe there's a possibility of dissimilar metals at that point? That if Rich is smart enough to put no locks on those dissimilar metals and or a dab of celastic adhesive so that the weather could not get at that junction, I'll bet you there are ways that he could stop any corrosion from giving him grief there. What do you think? Over to you, Mel.
No, I think it is because, from what I remember, again, this is what I heard and what I remember this discussion about a couple of years ago, that how they did it is the loops, it's a stiff wire, like a piece of number 12 wire, but not made, maybe it's aluminum wire, I don't think it was copper, and it was a stiff piece of wire, I guess a stiff piece of like you would use as the ground, aluminum ground wire, I guess that would be the best description. And what they did is they had like a clamp type of device that screwed it to the boom. So I guess if the weather is at it, maybe if you gave it adequate some kind of sealing, you wouldn't have any problem, Dick. Over.
My favorite way of feeding the driven element of a Yagi, the dipole driven element, is the T-match half-wave coax ballon. Half-wave coax ballon gives you plus and minus identical signal with reference to ground. That in turn feeds a T-match on the driven element. That allows you to make the driven element one solid piece of metal all the way through the center of the Yagi. And whether or not you insulate it and put it through the boom or put it on saddles up top, that's your choice. But I much prefer the driven element to be one solid piece of tubing as opposed to being broken in the middle with various feeding techniques. Let's see how far off center we are on this one. Rich, N2EO, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, well, you're giving me good information. I think, I know on this TechNet a number of times it was mentioned that one of the 6-meter antennas, the SWR, went sky high when it rained. And the comment was made that the company, I believe it was M Squared, was out in the desert where it's dry. And that's where they tested it. So I don't know if that was M Squared. I think it was. And that was my concern, Dick, because the antenna is very, very nice. Glenn Morton was getting because of the economy. Nobody wants to stock materials. But they got their raw materials in. They plan to ship it this week, so I'm looking at getting it up in a few weeks and getting the antenna in September, and then we're going to go with 2 meters and 70 centimeters above it. But that was my concern, Dick, the weather affecting the antenna and not being able to operate when it rains.
But you and Barry are smart enough to look at the materials involved, know whether or not there's dissimilar metals, and can apply corrective action. So I wouldn't let that be a showstopper. The people I know who have bought Force 12 antennas seem to be darn happy with them, performance-wise and physical strength-wise. So I'm having trouble believing that they would continue to build a product in a way that's going to give you grief. And even if they did make that mistake, I think you and Barry would be able to make that correction. Let me go over to Eric. Eric, one of the things that's mentioned is that when it comes to home video, three-dimensional television, observation. One of the things they worried about was something called vertical vergence. In other words, many a person will watch his television screen when his head is not completely vertical. He's laying on the sofa, so to speak, or he's laying on the floor. And that's going to disturb whether or not you still see three-dimensional. When I saw the movie Avatar with the three-dimensional glasses while I'm sitting there in the audience, I tried reversing the glasses, and sure enough, the things that were supposed to be coming toward me were going away from me. I saw hollow objects, if you know what I mean. And they also talk about some of the home video equipment blinking the eyes, the left eye versus the right eye, being clockwise and counterclockwise polarized, at 240 frames per second. That's one, I guess that's Blu-ray, but when it comes to television reception, they're blinking at 8.3 milliseconds, half of the frame rate. Might give us some words on what it's like with your three-dimensional TV and three-dimensional Blu-ray and how long you've had it and how happy you are with it. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Okay, well, there are a number of different systems out there, so what you experience in the cinema is what they call real 3D. It's their trademark. They do the left-hand and right-hand circle of polarization. There's a lot of stuff that goes into making 3D in terms of how the spacing of the eyeballs, let's put it that way, in terms of how the camera is set up. How we actually create that perception of depth. And according to the shot, if you've watched any of the World Cup, there's really a lot of experimenting going on in their 3D output. The various different types of displays pretty much operate the same way, but there's some slightly different techniques. Let me let it drop. Panasonic takes one approach, Samsung takes another approach, but essentially there's an infrared, in the case of the Samsung, there's an infrared LED that sends the information to the glasses, and the glasses actually are running at, here's the problem, you say half the frame rate, it's really running at the field rate, except that many of the displays take 3D Blu-ray, for example. If you were to look at that picture that was coming out of, it's actually a 1280 720p image, but there's two images side by side, and it's the actual display that overlays them, so that way they can be lined up and polarized correctly. In essence, you don't actually have to have polarized lenses, because they use these essentially liquid crystal glasses that, in essence, are shutters. And you blink left eye and you blink right eye. Both eyes are not on simultaneously. So your eyeball sees left eye, right eye, right image. And depending upon the type of display, there are pluses and minuses with it. I happen to have an LED LCD, and it takes a certain period of time for each one of those cells to change their state. Let me let it drop again. Okay. Now, you wind up with something called, some people call it ghosting or lag, where you don't get a complete left eye, right eye image. You get a little bit of leakage. You can even notice that in the theater. The real 3D glasses are pretty good at that. They get a pretty good complete separation between left eye and right eye. The Panasonic system is a little bit better. And systems that work with plasma, because there's a much faster turn on and turn off times, you have much less of those issues. But I wonder in the article, do they talk about what happens to people's perception after watching 3D TV for 2 or 3 hours and then, say, getting into their car, going down a flight of stairs? At the NAB, where we had hundreds of people watching 3D for like 25 minutes, and you could watch them bump into each other after the shelling was over. K2RIW, K2JAC.
Wow, no, that's not mentioned in the three articles. They did mention that the Avatar movie is flashing the left-right at 144 frames per second. I think the actual movie, so to speak, is moving through the projector, in the old-fashioned projectors, at something like 24 frames per second. So the 144 is exactly six times. I'm amazed that they had to use a 6-to-1 ratio in the movie Avatar, if I got that correct. And they also talked about the 1920 pixels by 1080 pixels, and taking half the number of pixels for left and right. I had a little trouble understanding what was going on there. But in the case of light-emitting diode-fed liquid crystal display television, I'm amazed that the liquid crystals can go on and off fast enough to allow you to separate left and right by the infrared flashes from the infrared bulb going to your glasses and that adjusting the timing. So I think you're telling me that there is some bleed because the liquid crystal cannot move fast enough compared to the 8.3 milliseconds of left versus 8.3 milliseconds of right in order for a complete field to be properly displayed. Back to you for some... by the way, what is the explanation for why people were bumping into each other? KE2EJ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, why people were bumping into each other? You see, when you put in these glasses, and you are now in an artificial 3D state, okay, your brain and your sense of equilibrium is really controlled by the cues of what you see. Your eyes use the cues of items that are fixed in place at various distances, and your brain kind of adjusts to that, and that also keeps your eyeballs tracking together the same. Now you're in this artificial environment where we want to create depth. So in essence, when we split the picture to create depth, your brain readjusts according to the artificial environment. Otherwise, you would find your eyeball separating and, you know, traveling either apart or closer together. And you wind up with a lot of muscle and eye strain. Actually, they do a lot of research into that kind of stuff to determine where things are. Companies like Sony and JVC and a few others have made 3D picture processes that, in essence, simulate 3D images from 2D images. Also, you'll find that many of the sets actually have a similar type of simulation within them. You can put it in this mode where it makes artificial 3D out of the 2D stuff that's coming in. I'm going to drop again. The actual output of 1080, 1920 pixels across the line, what it is it's the standard. It's 1920 by 1080, actually 24p progressive, so that way it's not interlaced. And you're actually spitting out real 24 frames per second. But what you do is you actually take the full frame of left eye and you display that between pixels 0 and 960, or whatever 1920 divided by 2 is, and you display the right eye image from that point to 1920. So, in essence, when you look at it without it being put into a set that understands it, it looks like you've got left eye picture on the left side, right eye picture on the right side, sort of like the old stereograph, but that, or, you know, a Viewmaster in terms of how it's organized. When you put it into the set, it overlays it properly, and then you flash left eye, right eye, left eye, right eye, and you see the perspective.
I have the impression there's a number of ways of making a three-dimensional image inside of a human head. The so-called Magic Eye Pictures, and I own a number of those books for Magic Eye 3D, these printings on a page look like overlapping pictures, and in order to see the three-dimensional effect, and a lot of people are not able to do it, you have to train your eyes in order to parallax at infinity but focus near. It's an opposite combination and it takes training to do that. So the book is 2 feet ahead of, in front of your head, and you've got to focus your eyes at 2 feet, but the parallax of your eyes are set as if the image was coming from infinity. And once you succeed in doing that, you see the third dimension on these magic eye pictures. And there's a smaller subset of these magic eye pictures where you've got to cross your eyes. And now your eyes are crossed as if the image is right in front of your nose, but again, your eyes are focused at 2 feet. In either of those cases, you get a three-dimensional image that's quite striking. Now,
that's because you've eliminated anything in your environment so that your brain gets the cues only from what your eyeballs see.
Now, when you take this 1920 pixels horizontal and 1080 pixels vertical, and you make the left eye the left-hand side of the screen and the right eye the right-hand side of the screen, and you wear the glasses, aren't you again forcing this phony kind of magic eye?
Negative.
Well, if the left side is...
Explain.
If the left side is the left side of the screen and the right eye is the right side of the screen, I'm forcing my eyes to parallax at infinity but focus on the real screen. Go ahead.
What I'm saying is a picture on the left side of the screen, a picture on the right side of the screen is what you would see if you go into a non-3D set. That's the actual television image that's coming out of the player. The player produces a stream that has a picture on the left side and a picture on the right side. That, in fact, goes into the display that understands 3D, and it overlays them one on top of each other.
Oh, I'm catching on. Okay, now, if the set was properly set for the proper range of the viewer in front of the TV set, I'd like to believe the parallax of the eyes and the three-dimensional characteristics and the focus of the eyes is approximately that of a real three-dimensional object. As such, I'm now a little bit curious as to why this loss of depth perception takes place, so that the person watching that picture for a half an hour goes away from the TV set and then bumps into people. Over to you, Eric.
Okay. We can create objects that are being thrown at you. And the way we do that is we actually separate the lenses from one another to create the depth coming in. We can make objects seem to go away from you. We, in essence, take the two object lenses and bring them closer together. All the natural cues that your brain uses for depth perception have gone away when you're viewing this artificial environment. Some people react to it instantly and they come back into their real world when the glasses come off. Other people's brains are slower. It takes them a little while to readjust to the actual environment.
Okay, I'm slowly catching on to that. Right now, I had the impression that the leading edge people, the people who don't care about the price of something and they want the bleeding edge of technology in their house, they're buying 3D sets. I had the impression they were a little bit pricey. I had the impression that only a small percentage of the population has done it so far. Also, you got a bit of a chicken and egg problem. It's hard to sell something, even if it's cheap, if there isn't a lot of programming. If only one program per week is going to be 3D, or only a soccer match is going to be in 3D, or one other sporting event per week, that's not quite enough incentive for some people. So what's your prediction? 5 or 7 years before 3D really catches on? But do you believe it's essentially inevitable, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Hi, at this point in time, K2RIW, K2J. You can go to DirecTV, and there's now 3 channels of 3D. One sports channel of 3D, one channel of Discovery in 3D, and one on-demand VOD downloadable 3D.
Two, meter, transmit.
Okay, so, That was Howie coming in there. I wish, Howie, you would turn off those announcements when you come and go. The selection of Blu-rays now has actually come up quite a bit. You know, in the DVD world, you could get anaglyphs with the red and green glasses. There's been a number of releases like that. There is a lot of actual 3D content from the 50s that's making its way to Blu-ray Avatar will probably be coming out in November in 3D. There are a few releases, and the number is growing. The number of sets out there is growing at a rate greater than most people thought would happen. By the same token, the number of HD displays out there is far greater than anybody thought would happen at a far greater rate than anybody thought would happen. So, go figure. K2RW, K2J.
K2HWW, you had a question on this subject?
Go ahead, Howie.
By the way, Eric, you know the 850, you can't turn off those announcements. They come up because I'm cross-linking from a 1200. Question. With all of this going on, what is the liability on these manufacturers? Somebody, you know, watches TV, gets into a car and has an accident, you know. And I'd like to know what the effect is of people with all kinds of different things, with different medical issues, because you are making a brain. If you have Tourette's, if you have anything else, I'm really curious to what really... Is the liability, have they done any studies, Eric, on the medical issues?
Actually, Ali, the manufacturer's a little bit scared. When you buy the product now, they warn you not to immediately go and do some operate heavy machinery and drive cars and stuff like that. So they're putting the caveats, the lawyers are putting the caveats in there to keep them from being legally liable. I think Australia has some laws on the books now that pertain to that. Hasn't hit this country yet. The Japanese have their warnings on their display devices, so it's not something that hasn't been thought of, and there are a number of universities doing studies on this stuff.
I'll tell you about another problem.
When you get a chance, Eric, I'm going to be asking you, what is the recommended period of time? You walk away from the television set and do something normal for 20 minutes before you operate heavy machinery? But Mel first. KE2EJ, K2RW, go ahead, Mel.
It's K2KEY, well, I'll quote this. I happened to see it in the paper, and I cut it out. They said, with, you know, watching the 3D, and it says people who have, yeah, as Eric was just mentioning about conditions, and people especially have wider apart eyes will have a wider range of depth perception and will have more confusion. Most people's eyes are separated by approximately 2.5 inches, but there are people that have wider eyes and will have a different will have a wider range of depth perception and will have possibly some side effects, Dick, over.
Yeah, if you remember, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis had eyes that were way out to the edge of her head. KE2EJ, K2RAW, go ahead, Eric.
Question on this subject, Dick?
Yeah, Eric first and then Howie. Go ahead, Eric.
All right. Well, the interesting thing that I found interesting is because, you know, on 2 days a week I'm working for a company that has one of the first fully loaded 3D trucks, and the method in which the cameras are put together. There's a couple different methods where some of the companies actually have two objectives that are side by side that look like eyeballs. But one of the other methods is to take one camera that's on a horizontal plane and another camera that's on a vertical plane and use a first surface mirror, and you can now really do a lot of stuff in terms of depth perception and how you can move the objective part of the cameras independent from one another, which is a little more difficult to do when you have the two objects side, you know, objective lenses side by side. What they do is they move it electronically as opposed to optically or mechanically. So, you know, you actually have to pay for that by either making sensors that are bigger or you lose resolution in some form, because what you're doing is you wind up under-scanning the sensor and you are then electronically moving that under-scanned section of the sensor left and right. There's a lot of interesting stuff. There's also some interesting 3D image processors that are coming out, and you know, is it just a fad? Will it last? Don't forget we had 3D movies in the 50s. They came and went, but you know, the anaglyphs were not necessarily really comfortable and, you know, gave you good colorimetry. With the real 3D glasses, it looks like you're putting on a neutral density filter. K2RIWK2EJ.
Yeah, I'd like to know when it comes back to you, what did James Cameron do with his cameras and techniques in order to create that movie Avatar? Howie, go ahead.
Ready for courtesy, Tom. The question I have they done studies, Eric, on epilepsy and people having reactions? Because there have been lawsuits in the video game business over people having reactions. And now when you leave a theater, how does it, okay, how much time do you have to wait before you can drive, and how much liability does the theater and the movie maker have on this? And also, even if you have a warning on the TV or in the owner's manual, I mean, anytime a guest comes or a person comes to your house or goes into a living room, you know, most people are not going to sit down and read a manual what to do and what not to do. So what is the liability issues? And is there any clear law on this, Eric?
No, as I mentioned before, Howie, in Australia, they actually have a law on the book. This country is kind of funny about stuff like that. If I put up a sign in a public place in my house stating that you, by entering, you hereby acknowledge the right to be videotaped, which is what we do a lot of times. By entering the studio, you give your consent, rather than having to take a release paper and have you sign the release paper. And it doesn't have to be a big sign, it just has to be big enough to be seen somewhere. You know, that kind of legal gray area is yet to be, we've yet to see a case, but I also believe in the movie theaters and the 3D theaters. As you walk into the theater, you may not notice it, but I think there's a little sign there too, and, well, at least I've seen it in some of the theaters, maybe not all of them. But in essence, by participating, you give your consent. As far as the period of time it takes, it depends on the individual, and it also depends upon how much artificial depth you've been subjected to. You know, if you're watching 10 minutes or an hour of it, it's probably not bad, but if you're watching 5 or 6 hours of it, you're going to have a different time to amount of time that it takes to reacclimate to your real environment. That's one of the things that a lot of the content producers are starting to make themselves aware of, because if you look in the movies, you know that more and more content is being produced in 3D. K2RW, K2JX.
Eric, do you have a gut feel that the average person is probably back to almost normal depth perception if he walks away from the 3D device for approximately a half hour and then goes drive? Do you think the average person in a half hour of normal living has essentially restored normal perception?
Well, I think we can judge from what we've seen in the movie theaters. You know, I mean, Avatar is a very long film. You know, it's just a worry on the part of people. Even at the large shows that I saw, yeah, they were banging into each other, but, you know, two or three minutes later, everything's kind of all back to normal. But there's going to be that one person that takes an hour or whatever, especially after watching TV for 5 or 6 hours, as some people do, if they shouldn't. Oh, and Howie, as far as, like, epilepsy goes, it doesn't matter whether it's 3D or not. You start flashing red on and off at a 1500 rate, you're going to cause an epileptic seizure. The 3D part of it doesn't seem to be an issue, because the rate of left eye, right eye is way faster than the response time. Most of those types of seizures happen at a much slower rate. The brain is kind of slow about that. So after a certain speed, it no longer has those effects. So there you go. Dick?
Let me ask another question, Dick.
Yeah, I'll go to you right after this one, and that is, do you believe about 20 hertz of flash rate is probably the peak of where you might create an epileptic effect, Eric?
I'm not an expert at that. I know I've read something about it, but I'm not going to say what the rate is, because I'm not sure. I'd just be, you know, blowing smoke at that point.
You got it, Howie.
Okay. Actually, I want to ask a question, and I want to ask a technical question, Dick. I don't know when you change subjects. on another subject. But Eric, the question that I have from a liability issue is this: not at a movie theater, but you go to a friend's house, you go into his living room, and you're watching this 3D, or you're watching an action show. Then you leave and get in the car and have an accident. Okay? What's the law? You know, this is very interesting law here, and very interesting. You're right. The average person may adjust in 3 or 4 minutes or 5 minutes, and another person may take an hour, all depending on his brain processes. I wonder how far back you can go with the liability. Can the liability go all the way back to the movie maker, to the radio station, to the network?
No, a case like that has yet to be tried. As long as the lawyers caveats they protect themselves. You know, a lot of things in this world, Howard, that may not necessarily appreciate because of your place in the world, so to speak. But it's a lot of stuff, you know. You got a creative lawyer, he's going to try and make some money out of it. You know, give it time, you'll probably see a case come up. But, you know, the human being pretty resilient. As far as the legal aspect of it goes, it really hasn't hit the court yet, and somebody's going to be a little creative and take it to some distance to the point where there's going to be a ruling of sorts. But the manufacturers themselves and the content producers at this point are... there we go. It's trying to protect itself. Let me take care of that, Dick.
Link clear.
Yeah, it looks like we've hit the bewitching hour. This was TechNet number 1309 of the series that began in September of 1982, 27 and a half years ago. Mel and I intend to be back next week, try to be kind to each other. Mel, I'll bet you the guys on Dover Street are not going to buy three-dimensional television immediately. I think they're going to hold off a little bit. I think the guys in Huntington might do that for a little while too, but I'm not sure. K2KEY, K2RIW.
No, not quite. I haven't got used to using this one that's only 20 years old right now, and it's just with one of those Phoenix converters on it, and it hasn't been turned on now. We'll turn it on. We turned it on last time.
Welcome to the Long Island
weather.
Mobile Amateur Radio Club computer system.
Much TV
Note number 9126 on the New England Reflector.
Link active.
In the kitchen. Okay, anyhow, I'll tell you about, I have a camera here that takes stereo pictures. And called TrueView, and it's got a viewer too. So I have that for about 40 years. I'll tell you about it sometime. It's an interesting device. 783s, catch you next week. K2KEY. Good night.
Out of curiosity, Mel, is that a camera that uses a Kodak film to make these stereo pictures? Go ahead.
Yeah, it was popular back, I think, in the 50s or 60s. Somebody gave me the whole outfit, and you put in. It takes two shots. Simultaneously, it's got two lenses with a synchronized shutter, and I got the whole theory of how it operates. I got the whole instruction book here, how it works, how your eyes perceive the stereo image, and it took it on, and it looks like 35 millimeter film, and you put it in this thing called the TrueView, Dick, over.
And how your TrueView thing? The stereograph viewers that were popular in 1920 or whatever, is it close in operation to that when you're viewing, Mel, go ahead.
This one's already more modern. It's a nice plastic case. It's not plastic. I guess it's most likely Bakelite for those days. And it has two lenses and it has a lever on the bottom so you can advance the film, which winds up. It's wound the film, in other words. You store it in a little can, and you put it in one side, and you load it, and it pushes through, with the perforations. Looks like regular film, Dick. Over.
Interesting. And my guess is the 35 millimeter film goes through the camera where you left. Are the two adjacent pictures, are the left and right pictures two adjacent frames of the film, or is there dead spaces in between? Go ahead.
Exactly, because, it's got to have that separation, that 2.5-inch separation. It's 2.5-inch separation on it. That's what they said it was for the average human being's eyes.
are 2.5 inches separation, over.
Very good. Okay, we're essentially through for the night, but go ahead with a brief one.